previously.tv podcast network.
This is the Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 105 for the week of February 15th, 2016. I am Ziploc flip phone David T. Cole, and I'm here with disputed baseball card collection Sarah D. Bunting.
Mint Dave Steve.
Extravagant tequila shot Joe Reed.
Bottoms up. Wait, what?
Naive senior citizen Tara Ariano.
Madlock!
And Chicago sunroof inventor Jeff Drake.
Are you seriously going to make me go all the way back?
Hello, everybody. We are back. Briefly. First, before we start, a programming note. Once again, next week, episode 106 is going to be another all-user game time.
Listener game time.
Listener game time, excuse me. Presumably also users of the site, previously.tv, I assume.
If you're not, don't tell us.
That's true. Don't tell us if you're not. Due to travel, so that is what is up next week. But this week, we are on our regular schedule, one big podcast, This Is It, plus four minis. And joining us all this week is Jeff Drake. Hi, Jeff.
Oh. Hi, Jeff.
Hey, Jeff.
Hi.
Jeff is here to join us in talking about the second season premiere of the Breaking Bad spinoff prequel Better Call Saul, which I will be covering all this season for previously.tv. And I wrote a lot in the first season about how scared I was that it was going to end up being terrible, and then it was so good, and I was equally kind of apprehensive for some reason about the season two premiere, and I think it has also been amazing too. What did everyone else think? Why don't we start with our guest Jeff Drake?
Yeah, I mean, I think I might be the last one on board out of this bunch since
it's,
you know,
a Breaking Bad tradition.
Yeah, it is really. But I mean, I think it was like, cause my wife and I had watched the, had watched the premiere of it, and,
you're ahead of me then, Jeff. So
yeah, but then we stopped, and I think it was just too close to Breaking Bad for us. And so like, just like, you know, 10 days ago, I started watching all of these and ended up watching the whole thing. And I think that having that extra distance really made a difference, because it is like, there are a lot of similarities, but it is such a different show. And I mean, it is really like, especially like once you get, not that the early episodes aren't great from the first season, but like once you get to the middle of the show, it's like it really hits a stride that's just kind of amazing. And I had the same sort of apprehension about like where they, like what's going to be up with season two. And I feel like I'm excited to see the rest of the season. So
I enjoyed this little tradition they've started where I assume at the beginning of each season we're going to get a vignette of his present day travel. You know.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. We open up with the horrible Jimmy or whatever his name is in the future working at his Cinnabon in Omaha, getting locked in a hallway.
Oh my God.
Getting locked in the garbage room.
Locked in the garbage room, not being able to let himself out because the cops will be called. It's just like, there are tragic figures, and then there's Jimmy McGill / Saul Goodman / whatever his name is now, and he just looks so pitiful. I mean, the over-the-head shot of his the top of his crown in his little Cinnabon visor is just like the extra indignity of like, wow, this guy really has a shitty life. I feel so bad. And then, you know, you get back to his heyday, such as it is, and you remember, oh yeah, he did a lot of pretty terrible things, I guess.
Right.
Not all of this is unwarranted.
Yeah, but I mean, I think one of the cool things about the show, and I think this is a hallmark of like, you know, you're watching a good show when like we all know he lives through all of this.
Right.
You know, but and same thing with same thing with Mike.
Yeah.
You know, we know that he makes it to Breaking Bad. Spoiler alert, maybe not so much after Breaking Bad. but like there are times that you like fear for both of their lives where you're like, oh shit, this is fucking bad or whatever. And it's just surprising to me for like for like Vince Gilligan and who is it? Is it Peter Gould? Yeah. Is that the co-creator?
Yep.
Like that they're able to like sort of be involved in two of these shows that are just really, really so terrific. They have a lot of similarities, but they couldn't be more different in some ways. You know, it's just impressive. It's just such a good show, I think.
Yeah, I was glad that Mike got to be back in charge a little bit more, sort of, in the season two premiere. That was the storyline that I called out in my first post on it, which was, you know, how Daniel Wormald, the would-be pill-selling drug dealer, learns that you always listen to what Mike Ehrmantraut tells you and do what he says, because otherwise bad things happen to you, as was mentioned up top in Sarah's reference to the disputed baseball card collection.
Yeah.
I mean, If I were to pick out one weakness of the episode, it's just sort of that, and like Mike's a fantastic character and I obviously love him, but there is no question that as soon as you get that first scene of that interaction, you're like, oh, okay, Mike's right. Everything he says is going to come to pass and this guy's going to get like, you know, fucked up in 12 different ways because of his like arrogance and hubris and whatever. And it's, you know, sort of like a classic almost, you know, downfall of man kind of thing, but it's there isn't a ton of suspense in terms of like, oh, maybe this time Mike will be wrong. No, Mike's not gonna be wrong this time. Mike's never wrong. Like, this guy's gonna
crime,
you know,
shaman.
Yeah, exactly.
But you know, about that though, you're right that, you know, you don't go against Mike, you know, you don't go against the Mike grain. But that whole setup and that actor who played that pill would be Pilsar guy,
Mark Brooks,
fantastic. Yeah. That characterization was excellent, and just the obliviousness. And like, I used to work with people kind of like that when I lived in LA the first time, and that, you know, just didn't have a sense of occasion and a sense of themselves in a certain situation.
Well, they were also computer professionals,
and they were also very nerdy, and that guy just nailed it. I mean, that was a really good sort of dumb performance, you know? Like, he really, I thought,
and it
walked
was
that fine line
so
between
well for him
character
too.
And caricature, you know?
Yeah, Sarah, you were saying?
Yeah, when my husband and I were first dating, he invited me to go to a baseball card show. And I was like, no, thank you. Like, immediately. And he was a little hurt by that, and he's like, well, but you still have your baseball cards and you really like baseball. I was like, that's baseball. Baseball card people, totally different thing. Yeah. I don't need that shit.
Right.
We were watching these episodes and we watched the first two and watching this guy dance like, oh, I see. I was like, yeah, this part, it's a documentary. No thanks. But it was so good, and like, Tequila Douche Ken,
yes,
was also perfectly done. Like, yeah, they didn't push it too far, his douchiness. It was just exactly right. And that actor has played
everyone.
Well, yeah, but was sort of a similar-ish character, not as overtly douchey on Those Who Kill, which,
oh,
like,
really?
I'm sure even he didn't watch that show because no one else did, because it was fucking terrible. But he has that perfect like kind of ham face for that. Yep. And was, you know, it was just written and directed perfectly, that it wasn't too cartoony. And that's one of the things I really like about the show, is that it's not like the fine brush strokes are really good, but not, it's not too proud of itself for that stuff. I think it's great.
This show, me, like, sinks or swims on how well it portrays Jimmy as a grifter. And we get that's what the Ken character is involved in this scene, where Jimmy is trying to show Kim, this is why I don't need to be a lawyer. I can just do short cons for the rest of my life. And then he sort of rooks her into tricking this guy out of buying them an entire bottle of extremely expensive tequila, $150 shot at a time. And she plays along. And then afterwards, like, she kind of gets it a little bit. But to her, it's just a vacation. And that sort of is a turning point to him to realize, like, oh, okay, this is not really a career as such. But he's so good. Like, he's obviously, Bob Odenkirk is a great actor, but like, Jimmy acting as a stooge is also like so fun and so fascinating to watch.
Who plays her?
Her name is Rhea Seahorn.
She was really good in this episode. I sort of jumped in. I haven't seen the first season yet. I think now after seeing this episode, I'm like even more certain that I'm going to end up doing that. I think the nice thing about TV as it is right now, particularly like sort of prestige TV, is they're structured so much like movies. Like the episodes are structured so much like movies that you really can just jump in at any point. Like even with something with so much story behind this, and like, I didn't know every little like nook and cranny, but like it all plays out so much like a movie that things you don't know play out like the kinds of ambiguities that you would find in like an indie film or something like that. And every single thing with him and her, and then the grift that they pull on Kyle Bornheimer is so like compelling and funny and fun and sort of satisfying, and their relationship to me is very interesting. I like the amount of rope that she gives him to sort of hang himself, and to the slack she gives him in terms of like, oh, I'm gonna see where you go with this. And I was sort of into it when they like started making out by the pool, actually.
Yeah, no, she's really good. I like you're totally right that you can just dip into this show and not remember. Like, I don't really remember some of the stuff, like some of the markers about like where we are in the timeline of this universe. And my husband never finished watching Breaking Bad except sort of being in the room with me at the end of the series. And he loves it. This is his absolute favorite show. And I also like that. And this has sort of always been true of this whole universe, that they cast people who look like people and not quite so much like that American newscaster grown in a lab, perfectly even chiclet teeth people. And that's what I like about her, that she's really pretty, but she also looks like someone that you might actually know personally, mm-hmm. and not this like giant like lollipop head.
Right.
Deity looking person.
The best looking ones are the ones you should be most suspicious of, like Howard. The guy at HHM who's like on the billboard and always super smarmy. My only disappointment with the premiere is that we didn't get to revisit where Chuck is. But spoiler alert, he does come back in episode 2, and that the resumption of his relationship with Jimmy is very satisfying and also upsetting. That sort of dyad is one of my favorites in the show, so I'm glad that it's
and the continuing season. The Foley work on the crinkling.
Oh God, yes.
Of his foil jacket is one of my favorite things in the culture.
Yeah, but I love that even like the detail of like Jimmy is always Jimmy, even when at the end of the premiere he takes the job at this other firm in Santa Fe, and they're showing off all the perks. He's like meeting apparently every single person that works at this firm, and they're all super excited to have him there. And he settles into his office. He's going to get a company car and everything. And even so, he still has to look around and ask if he can get a Coco Bello desk, which I looked it up. They're like $18,000. So like, even at this moment, he's like, well, how can I milk this opportunity as much as I can in case I'm only going to be here for 3 days? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
he's
well, and I also liked the way that the parallel to the would-be pill dealer is this thing where like, yeah, somebody like Jimmy is going to be there to grift when he can, but it's also just like these people who like just serve themselves up on platters sometimes. And like the assistant in the office was like doing that, just like, anything you want, yeah, I'll get right on that desk thing. And it's just like, okay, he's going to be able to like work these people because they are going to allow him to work them.
I'm going to speak carefully because we watched a couple episodes and my mind is fuzzy which one where it ended.
Yes,
was there a resolution to the baseball guy
that
cards.
Happens in episode 2.
Thank you.
Yep.
Great scene in episode 2.
Yes, there is. And it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. It's like one of those.
Does anyone else want a spinoff with Ermine Trout and Nacho? And their tiny little eyebrow movements of complete disgust with the square would-be criminals of the world?
Jeff, you were going to say before Dave spoke up.
Well, I mean, there's a ton of things to talk about. I mean, I love that this whole pilot episode is just an echo of like warnings from season 1.
Yeah.
Like you rip off, I like ripping off thieves because they can't call the cops, and the IT guy is so dumb that he gets ripped off and he calls the cops, and it's like, you know, and it's like thinking like their eyebrows are not going to be raised by his ridiculous car. And the fact that he has this priceless collection of baseball cards, but lives in kind of a shithole.
Yeah.
You know, it's like the fact that they're like looking around suspiciously doesn't even like occur to him, you know, like, why aren't you just out looking for the real guy? And the cops are like, oh, yeah, right. Yeah.
I did love when he was like, I understand that the first 48 hours are the most important in this situation. Yeah. I died. That was so great.
He really thinks.
I mean, but also, yeah, but also, like, at like Tara, when you were talking about, like, Jimmy settling in, like, I feel like it's just, like, it's like a perfect Jimmy moment of him sitting there and he like sees the light switch that says, yeah, do not turn off.
Yep.
Leave this on all the time. And he has to turn it off for a while to find out what happens. Mm-hmm. Like, of course he does that. Like that's the thing, you know, it's like, oh, well, like, you know, it's just like, but it's still like, to me, like the whole show is just like, this is a show that proves that you can do, because it's essentially just a legal drama.
Yeah.
You know, it proves that you can do a legal drama in a way that's not soapy. That's just like a good complex drama about characters who are very complex.
Yeah.
You know, and it's just interesting the subtlety of that just very, very slight shift of focus to turn it, you know, to like, it's not like, oh, this has to be on cable because of all of the sex scenes and all of the expletives. It's like, no, it has to be on cable because it has to have that, these characters have to have this amount of air to breathe every episode. Mm-hmm. And the payoffs are so high because of it. Like, it's just 10 episodes, but it's like, you know, packed full of every bit as much of like an emotional journey as like a 24 episodes of like whatever LA Law or pick another, like, you know, like, you know, drama.
The not that good anymore. Wife.
Century,
yeah.
City.
Yeah. Yeah. Century City. Exactly.
Century City. Good example. Yes.
Thank you.
Perfect. Everyone was thinking it, but you didn't have to say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. The story of how Jimmy becomes Saul and like how these different characters kind of impinge on his path and like send him in different directions, like, you know, wanting to stick to Howard puts him this way and wanting to be worthy of Kim sends him this way, and the thrill of getting a job from Mike puts him in another way. Like, he's fully himself so much, but at the same time he's so easily buffeted around because he has all these talents and like so many different ways to show them off, and not all of them are societally acceptable. So that's what makes the show fascinating to me. I'm so glad it's back.
Yeah. And stay tuned for that second episode, because
so
there's
good.
Yeah, I was trying to figure out like an equivalent, and doesn't have the comedy chops of it quite, but I think it's like up there with like the Silicon Valley dicks touching kind of thing. As far as building,
mm-hmm,
stacking comedy,
yep,
and just sort of working towards something.
As it were.
But I really enjoyed that. Like, it's going to be on the highlight reel, I think, for this show for sure.
Yeah,
for sure.
It's great.
All right.
Awesome.
Mom, we just finished watching season 10, episode 5 of Face Off.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe the challenge for me this week?
Everyone chose a parasite from underneath a microscope and made it a person. The host is what they called it for some reason.
Do you know what a parasite is?
And kind of like an insect, or... yeah, kind of like an insect, but way worse. It goes onto your body and starts infecting it. It doesn't kill you, but it doesn't help you live.
Good. And they were working in teams of two this week?
I find it funny that they've only had one individual challenge, and that's a spy challenge.
I know. While they were doing the design phase, Lance Henriksen from Alien, which you don't know, and it doesn't matter to me because I haven't seen Alien anyway, but Lance Henriksen, everyone was really excited about that guy. He's been in all the movies. He came in, and there was a sudden foundation challenge. What did they have to do?
They had to make slime for their parasite to come with.
And what did they win if they were the winners of the foundation challenge?
Immunity, But since they were working in pairs, both of the people got immunity.
That's right. And who won that foundation challenge?
Mel and Melissa, yeah. Which is kind of confusing because Mel, Melissa.
Mm-hmm. And they won because they had a very long, stretchy slime. If you were making slime, would you rather have sticky slime or drippy slime?
Drippy slime. Well, actually, could you mix both of them together and get kind of a thick texture that can kind of stretch, but it doesn't run down all gooey too slow?
I see. So you want a sticky slime that moves slowly but still drips?
Yes.
Okay. Now, Katie and Robert's model had a very big forehead seam when their project was done. Can you think of something that could be used to cover the seam instead of just trying to make it disappear?
Well, she looked like she was a hospital patient, so maybe a Band-Aid for her illness or something.
Like a bandage that went around the head?
Yeah, or some sort of tape painted like a cast so that it's sticky and it holds it down and it covers it and then no one knows.
Who was your favorite this week?
I don't really know. I think I liked Mel and Melissa's alien through blue-green textures.
Mm-hmm. And can you describe that one?
Kind of. So the victim, well, the host, the parasite came out through the host's mouth and then had a bunch of human teeth. It had a weird mouth mm-hmm. that connected into the nose.
And then they put the cowl all around the front, and it looked like a girl's face had just melted down on the bottom, and the parasite was coming up where her real head is. That was pretty cool.
That was pretty creepy, if you asked me.
And can you tell us who was the winner this week?
It was Caleb and Rob, but the real winner was Rob.
And the loser?
Was Robert and Katie. I don't think they work too well together, because each time they work together, they're totally opposite ideas. They never pool very well, and then they're always on the bottom.
Mm-hmm. And between the two of them, who was sent home?
Katie, because she made a cowl, and Rob made a worm guy whose name was Hamburger, I think.
I already forget what they were. Hans. Weren't they calling him Hans?
I think it was Ham.
Okay.
Or Hamburger.
Probably not.
Hey. Ham. Something like that.
Okay.
Probably because of his accent you heard, Hans.
I think he was actually saying Hans. Now, I don't think that it was really fair that Katie got sent home because she had even though they had that seam on the cowl, because she did the cowl, she did the paint job, she did the application, and all Robert did was make that little Hans thing, the brain worm. That's all he did for 3 days.
But it wasn't because of that. It's because her cowl had nothing. It looked just like a bald cap.
Yeah, but at least she made one. He didn't even make one. All he did was make one little thing that was coming out the side of the head. That doesn't seem like a fair distribution of work to me.
No, it doesn't.
Oh, well. So Katie got sent home. All right, well, thanks for speaking with me this week, Liv.
You're welcome. But we have a little treat. Ellie's here today.
Oh, Ellie, come on over. Hi, Ellie.
Hi, Mama.
What was your favorite makeup that you saw today?
The cow.
The cow? There was. Do you mean the cowl?
Yes.
Which cowl did you like? What color was it?
I don't remember, so. I'll just.
Did you like the slime?
Yeah, it was kind of weird and gross, so I didn't see that kind of part. It was gross, like the slime part.
Yeah? All right. Well, cool. Thanks for speaking with us this week, Ellie.
You're welcome, and we'll see you next on Face Off. Bye.
Bye.
Jesus. Really got to work on these transitions. Hello. It's time for another segment of The Blotter Presents. This week, I would like to talk about Jeffrey Toobin's The Run of His Life. You may be familiar with this tome. It is the book that American Crime Story is not based on, I guess, because it's an actual story. But Toobin, who is a lawyer and a journalist and legal analyst, is consulting on that, and I decided to put it on my Kindle and give it a read, and it's really well written. And, but he is not,
he is not afraid to be really rude to some of the players in this drama. Ooh. And I've just gotten to the part in the text where he is describing Robert Huizenga's testimony. You may remember this permed individual as he looks like Rand Paul and he's on The Biggest Loser. And
oh, that guy. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And apparently his testimony, like, he was called as a defense witness, and Tubin's description of just the, like, craven, desperate need on Dr. H's part to, like, help out his friend Juice and, like, sucking up to him even from the witness stand and, like, giving him the Kincaid eyes. I mean, it is to be withered to read this. It's amazing. I bookmarked like every page of that section. So it's very well written. And especially if you're wondering, like, how do they know if that happened? And, you know, was that really a thing? And you don't remember the case that well and sort of want to double check American Crime Story. I definitely recommend it. It's a fast read and very well written.
Did you read Game Change, Sarah? This is sort of a side note.
I did.
Because it sounds, the way you're describing it makes it sound like the game change of the O.J. Simpson trial, which I am into.
It is. I recently discovered while I was just researching this week's episode that there's all sorts of, first of all, there was another mini series in like 2000. And then there was the O.J. Simpson story in 1995, which is on YouTube, and it is the most terrifyingly poorly made thing. No. Like, even for this, it's, like, unwatchable. Mm. And then apparently Vincent Bugliosi, RIP, sure, who wrote Outrage about the O.J. Simpson case, and, like, it was just a giant list of all the ways the prosecution fucked up, which is true.
Yeah.
Like, self-produced his own 12-hour, like, lecture series about the case.
Yeesh.
Totally gonna watch it. I'll let you know. I'm gonna pack a couple lunches, and if you haven't heard from me in a couple days, that's why. God bless V-Bugs. He was really mad about how that case turned out.
I remember that. He was in, beside himself.
Yeah, he and Geraldo.
Yep. And Charles Grodin, weirdly enough.
Really?
Oh, God.
You remember that he had a CNBC talk show, Charles Grodin.
Oh, God.
And he talked about O.J. for like a good year.
Oh, my God. What a weird time in history, you guys.
Exactly. Exactly.
What was the title of the book again, sir?
The Run of His Life.
Outrage.
Oh, that one. Sorry.
No. The what you're talking about.
The Jeffrey Tubin.
Oh, The Run of His Life.
All right. So you can check it out. It is time to go around the dial. First stop. Tara Ariano.
I did not watch the Super Bowl, not because I'm interesting or above it, but I just don't care, which is how I missed the CBS announcement in the middle of it, apparently, that they were killing The Good Wife after all. This was long rumored because, you know, last month the Kings, who created the show, Robert and Michelle King, announced that they were not going to continue with the show if it got another season. And then like 2 weeks after that, Juliana Margulies was at something honoring them and made a reference to like, in April, I'm out of work or something. So everyone kind of put it together because they were not subtle.
Yeah.
But confirmed, we are now in, it was the final nine episodes now after this. There's only eight left. It's time. There's so many seasons. They've like done the same plot lines over and over again. So much. She's back at the same firm. Like, do they just not want to dismantle that set? It's so weird how they keep taking her out and then putting her back. Like, what are we wasting our time for?
It's like when you shoot the Terminator and all the mercury comes back and reforms.
Yeah. It's exactly like that in every way. I mean, like the idea of her having to rebuild stuff from scratch, like in Bond Court and stuff, or like when they were teasing us, like maybe she was going to go into business with Lewis Canning, like either of those was more interesting than what has actually happened. So after this week's episode sort of started out what I assume is going to be the final big story of like the end of the series, which is that this guy who's an FBI agent that was like on a sting operation to try and earlier in the season determine that Judge Shooter McGavin was taking bribes. Now he's back and he's investigating Alicia and maybe Peter, or maybe just Peter and Alicia's collateral damage. It's not clear yet who is actually the target of this. But the other problem, as I wrote in my post, is that like everyone on the show is so crooked, it could fucking be anything that they're investigating. Like the stakes are like at the same time super high and not high at all. Like, they're all, everyone is so shady. Anything could be what they're trying to determine. All of this by way of saying I will be very glad to have my Sunday nights back after the show ends. I've enjoyed watching it a lot of the time, but it was certainly the right time to end. And so I give CBS and the Kings credit for that, if nothing else.
Can I ask a quick question?
Yes.
Judge Shooter McGavin?
You know Christopher McDonald from Happy Gilmore?
Oh, yes.
He played as a judge this season.
And his name is Shooter McGavin.
No, that's his name in Happy Gilmore, Jeff.
Okay.
I was just calling him that as a humorous nickname.
Okay, that's... Okay, that... Look, it's...
I was trying to shorthand it. Obviously, it did not work.
Oh, my God.
His name is Judd Schakowsky. Don Schakowsky, I believe. So, for my plug.
Don Schakowsky!
Yes.
Can't not do it.
Oh, no. We lost Jeff. For my plugs this week, I wanted to give a shout out to two new contributors that have joined previously.tv this week. One is our friend Paul Quinn, who listeners of the Mark One version of this podcast may remember from Quinn's No Middle Ground segment. Now he is having No Middle Ground about American crime. It's the greatest show that's ever been on TV. So he is covering it for us and also covering Grey's Anatomy in the stead of our now departed, non-dead Joe Reed. Is someone that we found on our bulletin boards who was posting about Grey's Anatomy. Her name is Tina Mitchell. Her first post just went
bulletin
up last week.
Bulletin boards, eh?
Whatever, aww. The forums, whatever. Yeah. She posts about the show,
Dave.
On our site. Previously
best discovered on Fido
Net. She's on a listserv, everybody.
Found her on a listserv.
Fuck.
She's not a prodigy, but we found her on Prodigy. I can't see you, Tara, but I could feel the eyes.
All of this by way of saying, please go on our boards or forums or whatever it is appropriate
with
to
your
call
Netscape
them.
Browsing device.
And two, and post funny things about the show because you never know when we might be looking for someone to cover it for us, and it could be you. I also want to plug Catfish returns next week, the 24th of February. For its fifth season, I'm super duper excited too. Apparently, at least one episode this season was shot in Hilo, Hawaii, an hour and a half drive away from where we are. So I look forward to finding out what dirtbags are catfishing it up or being catfished this season.
Netscape, more like Mosaic, am I right?
Yes.
Jeff Drake.
First of all, in my defense, it's not like a network drama. Couldn't possibly have a name as ridiculous as Shooter McGavin.
Certainly not.
Anyway, moving on to something equally as terrible as that misstep that I just made. the HBO show Vinyl debuted with, as I was sad to discover once I started watching it, a two-hour episode on Sunday night. Somebody asked me how good it was.
How good was it, Jeff?
Oh boy, Joe, I really can't even tell you how terrific it was. It's this show is so. First of all, it's just boring. It's so boring. I was watching it with my wife, who really was just like, she was like, "How long is this?" And we had seen like 10 minutes of it. I mean, there is literally like a 90-second scene in it. Where he's falling asleep in the back, where Bobby Cannavale is falling asleep in the back of a car that's stuck in traffic. That's all that's happening.
So if you love Ray Donovan.
That's not all that's happening.
Oh my God.
Isn't there fake Led Zeppelin happening?
Oh, well, that happens at a different point. And a lot. They make it a central part of the plot that he's trying to sign Led Zeppelin. Of course, the problem being you can't use Led Zeppelin's music because it's too expensive. And so instead, they use a lot of fake Led Zeppelin, which just sounds like a terrible cover band trying to be Led Zeppelin.
Oh, boy.
In a show that's trying to be like this authentic piece of 70s rock memorabilia. It's so, but also, like, as I mentioned, like on the site, like, it's a show that's making heroes out of music executives. Like, who that's interested in music gives a shit about who signed the bands? Nobody. Nobody does. It's so It's so terrible, and you have to wait 54 minutes for your first orgy scene. It's really
unacceptable.
But who's counting?
Mentally you have a list of things that you're like Wendy was like, oh yeah, leather jacket, check, doing coke off a mirror, check, you know, and Wendy being my wife, for those of you who don't know. And then orgy scene, it was like, oh, well, of course there's going to be an orgy scene. So it is all, but also then in the second hour, it turns so entirely preposterous that it I don't even know what it is. I don't know what the show is other than terrible. But anyway, good job, HBO.
Well, thank you for covering it. You will continue to cover it as long as we continue paying you, I guess.
Sure,
and you don't have a plug here, but I wanted to also mention that you cover Top Chef for us as well.
I do that. And that show, at its worst, is so much more enjoyable than Vine.
Wow.
Joe.
Yeah.
So I'm going to talk about Saturday Night Live a little bit. Not the season as a whole or the quality of the show as a whole, because this is still – we're in year two of sort of a bit of a dark age for this show. Not in terms of like the level of talent, but like I feel like the way it's being utilized is just, you know, all encapsulated by their refusal to fix Weekend Update, which at this point to me feels like just a series of microaggressions every week where it's just like – It's come on, just stop it. Nobody likes these two. Nobody likes these two together. Like, try something else. Don't be quite so obstinate about that.
Yeah.
That said, I feel like the last 2 weeks they've really done a good job of like nobody's really expecting a good 90 minutes, like, you know, front to back anymore, or if they ever did. I think what you want out of Saturday Night Live is something that Sunday morning you go and you check your, you know, streaming services and you find something that's really fantastic. And I think they did that 2 weeks ago with the Larry David Burn Your Enthusiasm sketch, which I think did a good job of taking something that everybody really saw coming, where as soon as you saw that Larry David was going to be on, you knew they were going to do a Curb Your Enthusiasm thing and a Bernie Sanders thing and probably together. So I thought they did a really good job of getting the tone of that correctly. I've read some interviews with some of the writers, with Chris Kelly and I can't remember who the other writer was, but about talking about how they worked with Larry David and how sort of eager he was to work with them and how helpful he was. And I kept saying he was like the best guest host they ever had in terms of that, in terms of like working with them. And it turned out really well. It turned out like one of the better Curb Your Enthusiasm episodes that I can remember, actually, for as short as it was. They got a lot of stuff right. And then this week, they really kind of hit it out of the park with the Beyonce formation sketch, where it's sort of – it did that thing that I feel like good sketch comedy and a particularly good SNL sketch comedy did, was it sort of put its finger on something that you sort of felt was true but couldn't quite explain, which was the reaction to the Beyonce video and then the Beyonce halftime performance from white people being like not quite able to deal with the fact that something that was not made for them became super popular.
Happened. Yeah.
And exactly. And it was just like they hit the exact right tone of just like that kind of panic of just like, it's not for us, but things usually are for us. It was really good. And then I will also say, in addition to that, and that was fantastic, I got to give it up to my girl Vanessa Bayer.
There we go. I was waiting for it.
She was on Weekend Update and she did Jennifer Aniston impersonation as Rachel from Friends. It's not the first time she's pulled out this impersonation, but I think she's only done it once before. And it's A, so good. And it's B, like this like rare chance for her to just prove to be a really good impressionist, I guess. You know, she might not have a wide variety of impersonations that she nails, but she certainly nailed this one. Mm-hmm. And she's so fun, and she's been one of my favorite cast members forever. So I always Kate McKinnon deserves every bit of, you know, notoriety she gets for that show, and that's fine. But I do like the fact that Vanessa's been with the show for a while, and she's very consistent, and I liked that she got a little bit of shine this week. So.
Yep.
And in terms of plugs, on Decider.com this week, I do my Today in TV History column. And all this week, I am doing Simpsons Week on Today in TV History. If you go there today, on the day we're recording, I talk about the Das Bus episode of The Simpsons. Also coming up this week, Bart versus Australia, which is one of favorite ones.
Yep.
Homer's phobia, which, as I said on Twitter this week, first time that I actually got that that's a pun, which, like, aww, drive me out into the pasture and just sort of leave me there, because apparently I need to have some time to think about things. Because I was just like, no, it's Homer and he has a phobia. I don't, So that's me. Your Simpsons expert just figured out some basic shit. Decider.com, though, it's we do some good stuff there.
Dustbus is the one with We'll Live Like Kings. Damn hell, Last Kings.
Yep.
Oh, which okay. I still own that domain.
Mo. Nice, good. It's a good domain.
Yeah. Sarah.
Project Runway All-Stars has returned. They're really getting pretty elastic with the definition of stars and all.
And Project Runway.
Yeah, even here. Project Runway. But I'm not here to talk about the show. I'm here to address my remarks to Mrs. Alyssa Milano Bugliari, ma'am. If you are within the sound of my voice, please, we beg of you, the next time your stylist pulls out, por ejemplo, a bow neck blouse and giant indeterminate wash denim wide-legged gauchos for you, an individual who is 5 feet and 1 inch tall, please put it on your Pinterest board and take a fucking vote, because we know you're better than this. You're really good at hosting. You have cute hair. This has got to stop.
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree.
It is so ordered.
That's the non-sound of it stopping. Yeah, so that's happening. My esteemed colleague and wife, Tara, and I will be covering the show this season. So please check out our coverage and join us in the hashtag Free Alyssa. Free Alyssa movement. My plug is actually for our Teresa Giudice 360 coverage from last week.
When all over that, man.
Teresa was released from house arrest and
into the wild,
promptly attacked us on like every channel and with a book, which I did not read the whole thing because I couldn't, because I could feel IQ points dribbling out of my ear and down my neck. And
I'm sure you read more than she wrote. So
yes. Yes, I did. And if that is that ghostwriter's real name, I will eat a bunch of hats on TV because it just isn't. But yeah, it's terrible. And I was ably joined in that by Jordan V. And I would really like to thank him for surviving slash not killing me for assigning him those Watch What Happens lives, because I'm pretty sure I would not have been able to watch all of what happened and remain alive. So, Jordan, thank you.
What was the name?
Yay. I'm looking it up.
Oh, what was the name, Sarah?
Casey Baker. No way. No way is that real.
Nope.
Nice try, Casey Baker.
Not even Casey, like K, capital K, capital
Casey
C Baker.
Baker,
like, could not even be bothered to come up with two names.
Definitely
just
fake
initials, that'll go, that'll do.
Boo.
Yeah.
All right, everybody, it is time for the canon. Jeff Drake is here. Take it away, Jeffrey Drake Tholomew.
Well, thank you for having me back on the show, everybody. And this week, I am going to submit an episode of Fargo from season 2, the second episode, which I believe is called Before the Law. Is
correct
that the title?
Correct.
Before the Law.
Jeff, I'm just before you get into it, I just have a quick question for you.
Sure.
You've been on the show many times. You've made many canon presentations.
Yes.
Have you ever not had one get in?
Oh, yes. The last time. You'll recall the controversial Fawlty Towers.
Oh, of course. So, that's right. Yes. I did not mean to pour salt in the wound. I thought you had a perfect
that's
record.
All right.
I was trying to
that's
call
all
it
right
out. Not to say that
you know
this
what
will not bring it back.
Dave knows what he did. And
that's bullshit.
Sorry for the interruption.
I would like to find out which one of our recurring guests has a perfect record, though.
Don't mention the canon.
All right, Jeff,
that's,
proceed.
That's a Fawlty
all
Towers right joke.
Anyway, so I'm just going to come out and say it. Fargo, for me, Fargo season 2 was an instant classic, like stem to stern. It's one of the best seasons of any TV show I've ever seen. My wife and I rarely watch anything when it airs, but every Monday night we're like, oh boy, it's time for Fargo. And it filled that Game of Thrones-sized hole in our lives for 10 magical weeks. And picking out an episode was really difficult because I feel like you could make a case for any of the episodes of the season. And I wanted to – I stayed away from the first episode and from the episode with the big climactic gunfight because I wanted to pick an episode that someone could just like get on board with immediately, sort of like we talked about with Better Call Saul. But I didn't want it to be the first episode, which it for some dumb reason in my head that I can't recall now. So I chose episode two. I want to reiterate, like this sounds like just total hyperbole, but I think like I really think like everything about this show is like about as spot on as you could make it. I feel like the cast is amazing, the writing, the direction, and the music supervision is outrageous. It's just like they had the best choices for songs and the best inclusion of like period music that I've ever seen on a show, I think. And all of the actors are so great, and all of that they're perfect in their roles and perfectly chosen. So that said, to launch into this show that has it's got a big crime that it's building to, and we all know that it has a big crime that happens at the beginning in episode one that sort of like they're beginning to sort out in this episode. But like there's a bigger there are bigger themes at play in Fargo and in this episode in particular, it sort of plays out for the whole season. It's about war and the cost of war, and we begin after a couple of scenes with there's the Gerhardt family, and there's the patriarch of which has had a stroke, and so there are three brothers, one of which is dead, but nobody in the family knows that. And there's Dodd Gerhardt, who's played by Jeffrey Donovan, who, by the way, when my wife and I were watching this, we were like, who is that guy? I feel like I've seen him somewhere. And then when we looked it up, we were like, oh my God, it's the guy from Burn Notice.
He is Burn Notice.
Yep.
He is so great in this, but it's like this great scene where he seems to be interrogating a guy in a barn, and he's not really interrogating him. He's just regaling him with stories of what his dad did in World War II and how he got tortured and how the way that basically the way you're being tortured is nothing compared to how my dad was tortured. Meanwhile, the guy's dead. So Dodd's essentially not very good at his job. He's super excited, though, at the prospect of going to war with this Kansas City consortium who has come into town. They want to buy out the Gerhardt family. And he's so convinced that he is now the head of the family just simply because he's the oldest boy and his dad has had a stroke that he doesn't even consider the fact that his mom – is already stepping into that role. And he literally says to her, the boss can't be a woman. But Floyd, his mom, has a different take on the situation. Dave?
Eat.
I'm not hungry.
I'm your mother. You will eat with me. Your time will come. It will. But this isn't it. And if you stand by me now, I promise you that as soon as this crisis is over, I'll hand you your legacy and I'll turn my thoughts to the grave.
That's Jean Smart as Floyd Gerhardt, and she's amazing this as well. And this episode is very much about sort of setting the pieces in motion for what's going to happen. It's sort of like the repercussions of the crime at the Waffle Hut that happened in episode one, and sort of putting all of the different players in sort of pointing them in the direction of the gunfight that happens in episode nine. So the interesting thing about this is just like this sort of mounting sort of dread and suspense through this entire episode that doesn't really get relieved until future episodes. But it's kind of what makes the show so great is just like you just really get wrapped up in like wishing that these people could, like, there's always a simple solution to get out of this, you know? And it reminds me a lot of the movie A Simple Plan. And it's just like, you could, if you just take a slight turn, you could get out of this, but nobody can get out of their own way to do that. From that, we go to the people who've sort of caused this problem, which is Kirsten Dunst and Jesse Plemons, who play Ed and Peggy. And Peggy is the one who hit Rye Gerhart and killed him with her car. Well, mortally wounded him. He was later then killed by her husband in their garage. And there's this great split scene of the show uses the split screen really well throughout the entire run of the series, I think. And not just for like visual effect, I think, because there's a lot of shorthand, and these are a lot of characters who don't really talk about what's really going on. And so they use this to really show, like Jesse Plemons' character Ed, for instance, is just sort of racked with this guilt of he had to kill this guy in his own garage, and now he has to clean up all of the blood, and later he's going to have to get rid of the body in a way that only a butcher can get rid of a body. And so, like, there's a lot of just silent scenes where this using the split screen and just like the excellent just acting of the cast really tells the story of this, the two different stories of Ed and Peggy, where Ed is really like, he just kind of wants to get past this and get back to normalcy. And Peggy, for whom this is a very exciting change of routine. But like none of these characters are that self-aware, even though that's Peggy's whole journey, is like she thinks she's on this journey towards self-awareness. But Ed is going to clean up Peggy's mess. And it's just an interesting little note. Like Peggy then leaves the house and like in like her winter clothes with these bright red gloves and this bright red hat on. And it's like, it's so like Lady Macbeth, you know, she's got blood on her hands, and also like that it's on her head too, is like, that's like, it's all because of, she decided like, oh, she hit a guy and decided to drive home with a dead body, what she presumed was a dead body sticking in the window of her car. So Peggy then goes to work dressed like that, and she has a little encounter with her boss, Constance, who is trying to get her to go to this conference, this self-awareness kind of thing.
You talked to Ed?
Did I?
About the seminar next weekend. Got us a room at the South Nick Hotel.
Oh, yeah. I don't know. It's a lot of money, and we're saving up right now so Ed can buy the butcher shop.
What I'm hearing is you think your husband's more important than you, his needs.
No, I just, we got a plan, you know?
The word we is a castle hun with a moat and a drawbridge. And you know what gets locked up in castles?
Dragons.
Princesses. Don't be a prisoner of we. Take the seminar. It'll give you a key to the castle. Oh, hey, you don't know what happened to all the TP, do you?
The what's that?
Had a case of TP in the back last week. Somebody took it.
At that point, Kirsten Dunst just shrugs. And, of course, you know that she's the one who took the TP. The great thing about this is, like, there's also this weird sexual tension from Constance, who's, like, totally, like, staring at Kirsten Dunst's butt when she's turned around. And then later kind of has this, like, it's hard to tell exactly what motivation Constance is up to. We then cut to that, to the what I think is really a great pairing of music with Ed cleaning up the blood in the garage, and that's this Burl Ives song called "One Hour Ahead of the Posse," which is just sort of like that's kind of the theme of this, is like but in Ed and Peggy's case, like, they're hardly a minute ahead of the posse. They're just not smart enough. They just really think that they can make this problem go away. And of course, it's not going to go away for them. And just Jesse Plemons is so great in this role, especially coming off the last thing I saw him in, which is Breaking Bad, where he played an utter sociopath. And here he's just like this innocent, doughy, like just pure-hearted idiot. And it's just really great to see, like, to see that range. We stop at the Waffle Hut briefly, where we see the cop that we're sort of following is played by Patrick Wilson. He's Lou Salverson. He's the only character from season one. And we're back in the history of his, you know, sort of what brought him to he's the father of Molly, who's the main character of season one. But we just get a little dose of like the home life with him and his wife, played by what's her name? Christine Milioti. And how they just like really like are there for each other. Like she literally finds the murder weapon in the snow at the Waffle Hut. And while they're there, kind of he's trying to figure something out because something bugs him about the crime scene. And while they're there, a car full of the guys from Kansas City, the amazing Mike Milligan and the Kitchen Brothers, who are twins, Mike Milligan, played by Bokeem Woodbine, who's just amazing in this series. They drive by very slowly. And the next scene, we see them stopped on the road by Lou's father-in-law, played by Ted Danson, and who's curious what they're up to. And so they have this conversation.
Okay. I got your names and your plate number. I'm going to radio ahead and make sure you make it out of state. If not, I'm going to put out a APB and have you boys rounded up, and then we'll talk again. You understand?
I do. And isn't that a minor miracle? The state of the world today, the level of conflict and misunderstanding. That two men could stand on a lonely road in winter and talk calmly and rationally. While all around them, people were losing their mind.
The great thing about this show is like there's a scene like that where you're like, this is like the whole show has such a great Coen Brothers feel to it that you're like any moment this could erupt into violence. And there's a scene that similar to this where Lou has kind of a standoff with these three where literally guns are drawn, and you know he makes it to survives this season to go on to because he survived for season one, and it's like I'm afraid he's going to get killed right here. Later, Peggy gets brought home because her car has a giant hole in the windshield. She gets driven home by Constance. Constance asks to come in and use the bathroom and opens the cabinet and sees it's filled with the toilet paper that was stolen from the beauty shop they both work at. And here's the conversation they have.
You're kind of a bad girl, aren't you? Yeah, you are. I'm usually able to tell right away, but you had me fooled.
Oh, it's nothing. I just bumped it is all.
In the dust up. Thought you weren't in the car, you said. It's okay. You don't have to tell the truth. I'm not even mad about the TP. Next time, just ask, though. Or maybe that's what you like. Huh? Breaking the rules?
Thanks for the ride, okay? I got a real bad headache, like I said before, and maybe I'll just see you at work tomorrow, okay?
Sleep well now.
So again, this is, Constance has definitely a different agenda than Peggy does. And Peggy, it's interesting, what's interesting to me is like, Peggy never, throughout the course of this, never quite figures out like what her plan is, and she seems like she knows, like she's got a path in mind, but she's just not clever enough or sane enough to like figure it out. I think it's interesting that in the background, also on the radio, is the song "Kansas City" is playing, which is of course where the Kitchen Brothers and Mike Milligan are from. Finally, the whole thing sort of winds down. This episode does with Lou Salverson and his dad. His father-in-law sitting on the steps of the Waffle Hut. They're trying to figure it out, and they're sort of trying to put it into perspective of the experiences they've been through. They've both literally been to war. Lou is only recently back from Vietnam. They've both seen terrible things. They exchange actual stories of terrible things that they have seen. Unlike Dodd Gerhardt at the beginning, who is passing on, who you know is glorifying war. These guys do not glorify war at all or what it's done. And they have this brief conversation on the steps of the Waffle Hut.
War stories.
Different now, though. After WW2, we went 6 years without a murder here. 6 years. And these days, well, sometimes wonder if you boys didn't bring that war home with you.
Everything is being laid out for this series for, like, you know that this is going to end up tragically. I mean, you know that from the information that you heard in season one about how bad this shootout ends up being. And so then the episode ends with Lou driving home late at night, and he sees the light on at the butcher shop where Ed is busy trying to grind up Rye Gerhardt to get rid of the body. And there's a great moment where Lou knocks on the door, which distracts Ed just enough so that instead of chopping off a hand, he chops off fingers, and one of the fingers rolls out, and it becomes like this tense moment of, is Lou going to see that? Because Lou has come in, just saw the light on, wanted to pick up some bacon, and you know, there's a whole like, and of course Ed lets him in because everybody's so Minnesota nice that they're just like, sure, like, and he's just trying to keep up appearances that everything's okay. That blows over. Ed goes back to grinding up the body. Lou leaves, and then it ends with a very bizarre moment, which is from a song called "The Eve of War" that was written for a War of the Worlds thing that talks about sort of like this being viewed, all of these events being viewed from afar by like an alien presence. And of course, in the first episode, we saw a UFO, and later we will see. Later we will see it even more in the series. So like everything is laid out in this, which is a very, very tense episode filled with what I think is just like a ton of great understated performances and just some really, really just smart, incredible writing to like really tighten the strings as the episode goes along. And the show did that week after week, building to this great climax. And so that's why I think that this episode should be in the canon.
Jeff, I can't believe that you didn't mention in all the talk of Kansas City that is where you're from.
It is where I'm from. So,
are you a crime boss?
Do you wear a string tie?
That is the funny thing about Kansas City is there used to be such a huge crime presence there until the crime families blew each other up.
So, is that true?
Yeah, there was an area called the River Key that is now just called the River Market. And in the late 70s, there was a bunch of bombings and stuff because of the warring mafia families.
Oh, my God.
There is still, however, an amazing Italian restaurant down there. So
I will be there for a baseball conference.
So anyway.
That was a great presentation. I covered Fargo for the site both seasons, so I've watched all of these episodes at least twice, but it was a pleasure to get to watch this one again, particularly this early in the season before everything kind of goes to hell. Spoiler alert, ? I mean, I feel like you know things aren't going to end well, but at this early stage, it sort of seems like Floyd may yet prevail in the Gerhardt family and that they could continue doing business in a reasonable way and that it wouldn't get all dotted up. But that's not what occurs, unfortunately, for the Gerhardts. And I also never noticed until Dave played the clip of the Hank and Mike conversation, just the bit that you highlighted of them standing on the road when Mike says, isn't it amazing that we can stand here and communicate when all around us everyone else is losing their minds, which just sort of feels like a very, very early seed for another storyline involving Hank that pays out much later in the season with sort of a reveal of what he's been doing when he hasn't been around Betsy and Lou. And I also love the way that this show, even though it was sort of a side note, it wasn't really so much about the crime story, the portrayal of the Lou, Betsy, Hank triangle, because throughout the season, Betsy has cancer and she's being treated for it. And we know from season one, as you said, since that takes place chronologically later than this, obviously, it's when Molly is grown up. But we know that Betsy does not survive the disease. And so there's a lot of like just very lived in natural family stuff among the three of them, like Hank just stopping by and trying to be helpful, but not trying to be seen like he's being helpful, and her still trying to act normal, even though she's not like totally up to it, to, you know, get him coffee or whatever, like relate to him in the way that she did before, and how awkward it is for all of them because they're so Midwestern-y that none of them is really willing to talk about how all of this is making them feel. That feels very true to me as someone who comes from, you know, Canada's Midwest. And Hank a lot of times actually really reminds me of my grandpa in very emotional ways. But yeah, this is like, in some ways, this is better than the pilot or the series, the season premiere of this season in terms of getting you involved, because there's so many more splashy things that happen in the pilot that sort of pull focus from what the show does well in subtler ways. I mean, grinding up a body is not subtle, I guess, but the way that it's handled, the tension of that scene is very well done and delicate. And this is an excellent pick for and very representative of the season, even though everything is about to get much, much bigger and worse the longer it goes on. So thank you, Sarah.
I power watched the entire season this weekend. I mean, it was real cold here in Brooklyn, and the Fargo in the background was actually looking pretty toasty. It was like March in that universe. I adored it. I was a little concerned that it would not live up to the advanced billing, but I adored it. Dan adored it. I'm so glad you brought up the relationship amongst Hank, Lou, and Betsy, because we started, like, I accidentally called Ted Danson Dad Danson at some point.
Yeah.
In this role, and several of you have met my actual dad, he is very reminiscent of Dave Sr.
Yep.
The voice, the beard, everything. And we spent like the last few episodes like coiled with tension that he was going to be killed, because he was our favorite. And when he's like, we'll just be over here playing with, you know, eating sugar cereal and playing with my service revolver, that I was like, that's totally something Dad Bunting would say to his grandchild. I love the way that this world feels complete and they don't explain everything to you necessarily. I love later in the season that the quote unquote big reveal about the spaceship is kind of not that they're rushing off and Peggy's like, yeah, it's just a flying saucer. We gotta go. This episode specifically, I think it's an excellent choice, because I agree that like there was a little too much, not housekeeping, but like the premiere was premiere-y and was setting everything in motion. But this episode is also where I really got on board with Bokeem Woodbine's performance. I've hated him in every single other thing he's been in, regardless of how good the project was. I was just like, why does this guy keep getting chances? Who does he have naked pictures of? He is very cool looking and charismatic. Not a good actor. And it was like, oh, here's your lane.
Yeah.
That's awesome. He's really good. This was where I started to notice how many little tiny homages to like other Coen projects were all over the show. The music cues, the using soundtrack stuff from Oh Brother, Where Art Thou, the way things are framed. So that was cool. I'm a big Coen fan, except when I'm not. And
it's either right or wrong.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh?
Said it's either right or wrong.
It's either right or wrong. Yeah. That's about right.
That is correct. Or it's not. Yeah. I mean, it was so, it was like really fun to whatever, have an excuse to just marinate in a show. You know, unfortunately, we don't necessarily have a lot of time to experience shows just as shows versus that we're covering them. And this way I got to sort of have it both ways, think about it, to talk about it here, but also just watch it. And it's a really great show. And I thought this was a really great presentation. And I was so excited to see Elizabeth Marvel as Constance and like just having the time of her life and looking super pretty. I hope she got to keep all the outfits. Yeah, great submission. Thank you so much for quote unquote forcing me to watch 10 hours of TV.
Joe.
First of all, thank you, Jeff, for the fantastic presentation. I am unfortunately just a broken person. I keep trying to get into this show, and I the problem is clearly mine. There are any number of avenues into this show that I should be able to get into. I'm loving even like it's not even like it's actors that I like giving performances that I don't like. I like what Ted Danson's doing. I like what Kirsten Dunst is doing. Jean Smart and Elizabeth Marvel. Bokeem Woodbine, like you said, Sarah, is so good in this. Everything about the story feels like something that I personally am just like, I can't do another story of like good people who do something wrong, and then the whole idea of the story is that they're trying to cover up this thing that they did, or else there wouldn't be a story, which is the entire Kirsten Dunst, Jesse Plemons thing. And it's just like, would this not be completely unnecessary if you'd just been like, I hit a guy, he jumped in front of my car. You know what I mean? Like, and
the idiot plot. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. And I mean, I get
sometimes
that.
Like, I don't usually buy it either, but I totally see what you're saying.
Right. That's like, that's 30% of our American storytelling. So like, I get it. But why this particular one is the straw that broke the camel's back for me is whatever. I don't know. My eyes sometimes glaze over when it gets into a lot of like mob jockeying for a position. It's never my most interesting thing. It's certainly not my most interesting thing when Brad Garrett is involved, but like I can sort of like intellectually see what they're doing with it in terms of moving the pieces around the board, and that's all very good. And I think with somebody like the Ted Danson character, he's really making me care about the stuff in the family, even though the stuff with the family also feels like I can probably plot ahead where that is going too. I really am tired of the sort of philosophizing villain which is all sort of what Mike's monologues are to Danson and to the guy who he sort of wraps up in the typewriter. It's just a lot of things adding up where it's just like, yeah, like I just feel like I've seen this all before in other ways. And I completely like understand where the nuances of this and the sort of the spirit of the performances and the callbacks and everything like that would be working for you. It just really doesn't work for me. And at the very least, like I'd seen the season premiere of this season and I was like, I should go back and give it another shot. Like it's me. I was, you know, maybe not in the mood to like really dig into it that day. I'm like, now at the very least, I've seen the second episode. I just know I'm not having it. And that's all. Jeff, it is not you. It is me. I am at fault here. Please feel free to pass by me.
Why are you making this out like it's you're a bad person? Everything is.
It just
for
it feels. It
reason.
Does. It feels that
he
way.
He is a terrible like, person.
Not because
America
of this.
Yeah, there's lots of other reasons.
It's okay, Joe. Dave.
All right. I don't have a lot of new stuff to add, except I really agree with Dad Ted Danson. I really enjoy his performance, and as much as I enjoy,
especially for you, because your dad was he did that job.
That's right. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Much
as I enjoyed that performance, I hated Mike. Ugh, Joe, I'm so with you with the philosophizing villain character. And I think this guy was like in a different, you know, series than these other people. If everybody else was in Fargo, like this guy was in a Quentin Tarantino movie or something. It was, to me, like every time he appeared on the screen, it pulled me out a little bit. And I don't know if that stilted delivery was like a choice or just the way he does things. I don't know if I've ever seen him in anything else.
I don't know.
Okay. Everybody seems to have seen him in stuff and hated him.
But I think it's just him.
Yeah. Did not like, but the rest of the show, I agree with Tara and Sarah on all the points there. This is running a little long, so I'll just keep it at that, saying that I really enjoyed it. I've talked about this series, especially season two, a lot in the past, you know, 8 months or so when it was on, always saying it. I even enjoy the aliens bit. Let's go to the vote. Tara.
I did not like the aliens, but there wasn't much of them in this one, so I vote yay.
Sarah D. Bunting.
I vote yay.
Joe Reed.
I vote no.
All right, well, I got a little surprise for you guys.
Shut up. We're not voting. I'm oldest. I'm boss. End of story.
All right, so being the oldest person in the voting community here, I put in the one true vote, and that is for this episode to be in the canon. By Davy Decree, Fargo, Season 2, Episode 2, Before the Law, you are hereby inducted into the Extra Holocry canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yeah.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
It's time for winner and a loser of the week. Tara has a winner.
Winner is Bill Cosby because Kanye West thinks he's innocent, apparently.
Oh my God.
Congratulations, Dr. Cosby.
Yeah. The most hilarious thing about that tweet wasn't just that he did it, which, you know, whatever. Like, I don't even know why people continue to follow Kanye, I guess because of stuff like this. But the idea that Bill Cosby would see that and be really appalled because in his barrage of rape scandal days, he would have despised everything that Kanye West stood for and been
baggy
very judgmental
pants
about
wearing
it.
Hoodlum.
Exactly.
Yep, exactly.
So the irony was not lost on me, but congratulations to Bill Cosby, I guess.
Good on you, Bill. Mm-hmm. Now, if only, you know, you got Kanye West, and now you just got another 300 million people to go. Loser League, yes. Michael, yep. What is this guy's last name? Sculpin?
Scoopin.
Scoopin. You may remember him from Survivor, from
season two.
Short Eye.
Yeah.
Australia, I think.
Yes, I think that's Australia, Outback.
Outback.
Yeah,
yep.
Outback.
Recently arrested on child pornography charges.
Mm-hmm.
Among other things.
Among other things.
I think there were fraud charges, and this seemed to sort of get
And a pyramid scheme?
Yeah, well, that's why they had his computer in the first place, is because
was
they
it
were
a pyramid of
that.
Polaroids? That's gross.
Yeah. Anyway.
This is old news, you know, because, you know, we had the listener Game Time last week, but I just really wanted to bring up so I can just say this. And you may remember that he was the fellow that fell asleep and fell into the fire. So I guess they caught him red handed.
Yeah!
That brings up an interesting question. Do you know what time it is?
It's Game Time.
It's Game Time.
Oh, not Game Time.
All right, this is the second Game Time of this season. Joe won the first one, so he's king of the hill right now.
Yep.
Today we are playing Is This Anything, again, the Extra Hot Great Assist Edition.
Hey!
This was started and organized by Dave from Chicago, who earns himself an extra credit, redeemable for an Extra Hot Great mini topic of his choosing. All right, we got 13 rounds of true or false TV questions for you.
Oh, boy.
13 rounds of true or false questions await you.
True?
True! The rules are easy to understand.
True?
But you had trouble with this little true or false bit.
True.
All right, we're throwing it to Picky.
True.
We will start with Tara.
All right, we're going Tara, Jeff, Joe, Sarah. That is our order. Are we ready to play Is This Anything?
Yes.
All right, here we go. By the way, Tara got 3 Dave points there. Joe got 1.
Oh, okay.
The following is an item from the My Name is Earl list of reparations. Okay. All right, true or false?
Okay.
Tara Ariano.
Yep.
Always took a penny, never left a penny.
True.
Correct. Joe gave out raisins for Halloween.
I think it's Jeff.
Oh, yes, yeah, sorry, Jeff.
Jeff.
My bad. Jeff.
Oh, are we still on? This is...
Gave out raisins
still
for
on
Halloween.
My Name is Earl?
Yeah, yes.
True.
Incorrect. Oh, Joe.
Should have been.
Faked death to break up with girl.
True.
Sarah. Larceny of a kitty cat.
Larceny of a kitty cat. Sounds true. True.
Is. Tara Ariano.
Yes, sir.
Pretended to officiate a wedding, never got ordained.
False.
Correct.
Hey.
Jeff. Wasn't kind,
yes.
Didn't rewind.
True.
False.
Yes, the streak continues.
Joe Reed made a lady think he was God.
True.
Correct.
Confident.
Sarah, last question in round one. Got drunk on Easter.
Oh, that's a tough one. It's one of those that sounds really real. I think it's real. True.
It is real.
Nice.
All right, round two. This is a title of an original song from Glee.
Oh,
true
no.
or false?
God,
the
oh,
originals.
God.
Original
Jeez.
Song from Glee, Tara.
Barf.
Hell to the no.
True.
Jeff, Freaks on Fleek.
False.
Correct.
Yay.
Joe, Trouty Mouth.
Oh, I mean, that was a thing on the show. I'm going to say true.
Correct. Sarah, Bop to the Top.
Bop to the Top. I don't want that to be true, so false.
Correct. That was from High School Musical.
Oh, yeah. I knew that sounded familiar.
Back to Tara.
Yeah.
Outcast.
True.
Jeff, Loser Like Me.
False.
True. Joe, The Me Inside of Me.
Ew.
That sounds like something that I think is also from another show, so I'm going to say false.
Hey.
Correct. That was from Heather's off Broadway
yeah,
musical.
Okay.
Well done. Last question for Sarah. Nice to meet you. Have I slept with you?
Once again to the wish board. True.
It is true. It is true. All right, round three. This celebrity demonstrated this talent on Circus of the Stars.
Okay.
Oh, my God.
Number 17, this is.
Spread eagle. Does someone do the spread eagle?
Oh, my goodness.
Is that their talent?
Ew.
Well, let's see. Bronson Pinchot.
Oh, no. Yes.
Trapeze. And this is for Tara.
Yes. True.
Correct. And there's a note on this one. There's no trick answers with a person who did another talent.
I see.
Okay, so we're not going to say
okay.
Bronson Pinchot did
juggling.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Okay.
Jeff. Gabrielle.
Yes.
Carteris.
Carteris
and the tightrope.
True.
True. And you would know that if you're listening to, again with this, Beverly Hills 90210, where she also demonstrated that talent.
Oh.
Remember?
Yes.
You guys talked about it.
No, I remember that, but I didn't know she did it for real. I just assumed it was all fakey for 90210.
Oh, I thought we actually discussed that she actually did it.
I don't know. Maybe.
Huh. For Joe, Adam West demonstrated this talent, which was refereed dogs playing soccer on Circus of the Stars. True or false?
If only they were playing poker. False?
True. Sarah Bunting. Picky likes you. David Hasselhoff is the star. Lasso tricks. True or false?
Wow. I think that's false.
That is false. All right, Tara. Yeah. Jaleel White.
Yes.
Magic. Magic sawed Jenna Von Oy in half.
False.
That is false. Who the hell is Jenna Von Oy?
He was six on Blossom.
He was on Blossom.
Ah, okay. Jeff Drake, Vanilla Ice, drove a motorcycle through a wall of fire.
True.
Is true. Joe Reed, Lonnie Anderson, walked on broken glass.
What? No, false.
True.
What?
Sarah Bunting. Wow. This is the most picky thing ever. All right. Sarah Bunting, Luke Perry, wearing a beard of bees.
How dare you talk about Shannon Doherty that way?
Oh, no matter what happens, I'll always have that mental image. But I think it's false.
You are correct. That is false. All right. Round four, guys.
Yes.
This is a board game turned into a TV game show.
Okay.
Tara, concentration.
Yeah. True.
Jeff, Boggle.
Yes. True.
Joe, Stratego.
Ooh. Ugh. Oh, man. The problem is, I know Stratego's a game, but I don't know how it's played, so I don't know if it's even translatable to a game show.
This is a millionaire. Is this true or false?
Can I call my dad? I'm going to say false.
Correct.
It's like Risk, right?
Stratego? No, it's...
It's like Battleship, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, kind of. I don't know. It's...
Okay.
Doesn't last as long as Risk, anyways.
Gotcha.
Jenga, Sarah.
True.
False.
Ah.
Tara, Balderdash.
True.
Jeff Drake.
Sorry. Sorry.
That's your clue. Sorry.
Sorry is the game.
I'm sorry.
No.
It was sorry?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay. False.
Correct. There was no sorry TV game show. Joe, Monopoly. Now, Monopoly was originally called the Landlord's Game. And then it was sold to Parker Brothers,
okay,
where they changed it.
City Ahoy.
Now, back in the early 80s in Buffalo.
Back when I lived on Ventnor Avenue. True?
Sarah Bunting, Operation.
False.
Tara, Pictionary.
True.
Jeff, Scrabble.
True.
Joe, Mousetrap.
False.
Sarah Bunting, bring us into our first score break, Risk.
Risk. True.
A game
it's
of Risk
like
lasts on average 6 hours. I would
yeah,
be really interested.
Adapt it in any number of ways.
I'd be really interested
yeah,
to see how they would
the
adapt it. Let me finish my thought.
About the
Jesus Christ, people. All right. It's time for our first score break,
oh,
Tara.
My God. It is so close, you guys. Jeff has 6. Sarah and Joe are tied with 7. I have 9.
All right.
Very, very close game.
It's time to continue with some of our most defensive contestants. This is a case investigated by Veronica Mars.
Okay.
Tara.
Yeah.
Dog napping ring.
True.
Jeff. Stolen parrot.
True.
Yep, that was the basketball team's mascot. Yeah. Joe. Missing laboratory monkey.
False.
True.
Really?
Sarah D. Bunting. Lost football playbook.
False.
True. Tara.
Yeah.
Stolen prom queen crown.
False.
Correct. Jeff, missing senior class trip money.
True.
And for Joe, undercover in a cult.
True.
And Sarah, counterfeit parking permits.
Sounds real, but false.
You are correct.
Wow.
All right, that was round six. Round seven, this is a twee death from pushing daisies. True or false? Tara.
Yeah.
There's a note here that it doesn't matter. Fuck it. All right. Drowned in taffy. Who cares?
Okay, pushing. Say that again. Sorry.
Drowned in taffy.
Drowned in taffy. True.
Jeff choked on harmonica.
Oh, God. Wow, that one. I'll just go true.
False.
Feels true.
Yeah.
Though.
Yeah, it really does.
Joe Reed, explosive scratch and sniff book.
Wow. True.
Yeah.
What?
Sarah, pushed off a tower by a stray pig.
By a stray pig.
Yeah.
Not a pet pig. True.
Wow.
Tara, crammed into a dollhouse.
False?
Correct.
Whoa.
Jeff, eaten by a shark while synchronized swimming.
False.
True.
God damn it!
This show is bananas.
Joe Reed.
Yes.
It's like, it sounds basically like a mirror image of 6 Feet Under. So
yeah, kind of. Yeah.
Well, what I was going to say was you can get the through line to Hannibal now a little bit, hearing all of these back to back to back.
True.
Strangled by a ribbon dancer's ribbon.
Oh. False.
Correct. Sarah Bunting, blinded by glitter, walked into traffic.
True.
False.
No, that sounds like Deschanel is going to die.
Round eight. This is an occupation Jared had on The Pretender.
Oh, God.
Tara, gigolo.
Yeah. Obviously true.
Jeff, race car driver.
True.
Joe, bodyguard.
True.
Sarah, radio clown.
False.
True. Tara.
Yeah.
FBI agent.
False.
True.
Well, too obvious.
Jeff, sex therapist.
False.
True. Joe, bounty hunter.
This is another one that feels too obvious, but I'm going to say true.
True. And Sarah D. Bunting, news cameraman.
True.
All of those were true. Every single one. Round whatever we're at, I forget, doesn't matter. This show was pulled from air and canceled within 5 episodes or less.
Oh, boy.
Ooh. True or false? Tara.
Yeah.
Emily's reasons why not.
True.
For a Dave point, how many episodes?
1.
Jeff Drake, Push Nevada.
I'm sorry?
Push Nevada.
Oh, true.
Incorrect. 7 episodes.
What?
7 episodes. Joe Reed, Viva Laughlin.
True.
How many episodes?
2.
Well done. Is that for a Dave point as
That's
well?
That's for a Dave point, yeah.
Okay.
Sarah Bunting, The Playboy Club.
Oh, the Playboy Club.
Everybody.
5 or fewer?
Yes, 5 or less. Right?
True.
Correct. How many episodes?
I think 4.
Close, 3. Tara.
Yeah.
The other one from Pan Am.
Pan Am? This one I know it did not because I watched them all. False.
You are correct. 14 episodes.
Why did I watch that whole show?
Why?
I don't know, but I did.
Jeff Drake, The Paul Reiser Show.
that is true.
And how many episodes?
2.
That's good for a day point for the value guess.
Yeah.
All right, Joe, The Michael J. Fox Show.
Oh. Huh. I'm going to say they tried to make that happen for at least a little bit, so I'm going to say false.
Correct. 15 episodes that lasted.
Wow.
Sarah D. Bunting, Sean Saves the World, I believe was a contemporary of the Michael J. Fox Show.
You're correct, Dave.
Sean Saves the World?
Yep.
I never even heard of that shit.
It's with Sean Hayes from
just like 2 years ago.
Oh, yeah. But I feel like maybe they tried to make a go of that. I don't even remember. Let's hope it was true.
balls. It lasted also 15 episodes. Writing
Why?
Coattails of the Michael Bleh. J. Fox Show. Tara Ariano, how to live with your parents for the rest of your life.
Oh, God. I'm going to say true.
Balls. Shit. 13 episodes that lasted.
Wow.
Jeff, welcome to the family.
So many of these are NBC shows from the last couple of years. Wow. Welcome to the family. I'm going to say...
Which one was that?
That's the... They were Latino.
Okay. Oh, there's your answer right there.
True.
Am I right?
True.
All right. How many episodes, Jeff?
Four.
Three. Uno, dos. We are men.
Joke.
Yes, we are, Dave. Yes, we are. I feel like this was one of those where we did a contest on this podcast to see who could guess which one would get canceled first.
Is this
I think
a
I got it.
Project,
oh, yeah. I think that's right.
Yeah. I think I got this right. I think it was this was under five. Yes.
How many under five?
Three.
Close. Two.
Two.
All right.
That was a terrible
last
show.
Question before the next score break.
For Sarah.
How to be a gentleman.
Oh my God.
What? How to be a gentleman? I don't even know. False.
It's about those Buffy creatures.
Good news for this one. Both answers are correct. After reading the note, I'm going to give you an answer either way. CBS 2011 pulled it after three episodes, but then burnt it off in the summer with another six.
That was the one that Rickety Crickets from It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia was in and possibly wrote, who is married to Bones in real life.
All right. There are five rounds left.
Okay. Jeff has 11. Sarah has 12. Joe has 15. I have 16. Very close game still.
All right. Back to Is This Anything? Kevin Bacon was on this show. Bored to death, Tara.
False.
True. No, wait. Sorry. It is true. You are wrong.
Got it. No point.
No points for Tara. Jeff, Will and Grace.
True.
Correct.
Damn right he was.
Joe, Mad About You.
True.
Guiding Light for Sarah.
Who's on one of those? Let's hope it's that one. True.
Nice.
Just Shoot Me, Tara.
False.
Correct. He was not. Jeff Drake, Entourage.
True.
He was not. Ooh. Joe, The Dating Game.
True.
False.
Tricky.
Sarah, The Larry Sanders Show.
True.
No, wait, sorry.
False. Oh, shit.
The wrong one. I'm sorry. No points. Sorry.
I don't.
All right. Next round. This is a Hanna-Barbera cartoon.
Okay.
Oh, God.
Tara.
Yeah.
The New Shmoo.
True. Go
Jeff.
Home, Hanna and Barbera. You're both drunk.
Yogi's Space Race.
True.
Joe. Scooby's All-Star Laugh Olympics.
True.
Sarah Bunting. Partridge Family 2200 AD is probably what they called it.
Yes, that was a show.
Yeah. Tara.
We wrote about it in the book.
Help, it's the Hair Bear Bunch.
Help, it's Help, the Hair Bear
it's
Bunch.
It's the Hair Bear Bunch.
It sounds so asinine that it feels like it has to be true, but I'm still going to say false.
True.
I remember it.
Oh, God.
Me too.
All right, let's see if Jeff's memory serves him well here. Chattanooga Cats.
Chattanooga Cats?
Yep.
Chattanooga Cats?
Well, no. Is that how you say it?
I don't know.
No, it says
like
cat.
City?
There's no H.
Okay.
So
Chattanooga. All right,
I guess it's cats, you see, so it's Chattanooga Cats.
I understand.
I'll say it's noogies. True.
Sorry, Jeff says true, and he gets the point.
Alrighty.
Joe, Foofer.
What?
Foofer.
F-O-O-F-U-R. I don't even know her.
Don't you?
That sounds like a euphemism that a really uptight mom would come up with for farting.
This one also seems too crazy to not be true, so I'm going to say true.
Correct. Sarah Bunting scampers to the rescue.
Before I answer,
yeah.
I would just like to remind everyone of my own grandmother's euphemism for farts.
Yes, which is?
Pussycat.
Oh, no.
No.
Which was used as a verb.
Oh,
did
boy.
Someone pussycat in here?
My great aunt used to say, did someone let a rose? That's how uptight she was.
Wow.
I read something on the internet today that a grandma farted and then said, not bad from a 1H speaker. That's pretty good.
Yeah, that's
scampers to the rescue. True or false?
Oh, I've stalled long enough to talk of farts. Gonna have to make a decision, and that is as follows. It is true.
Oh no.
That is not a real show.
Damn
Tara,
scampers.
Mice
yes.
capades.
True. Oh.
Jeff, what's new with you, Mr. Magoo?
True.
Nope.
What?
Joe, inch high private eye.
Oh, wow. True?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a filthy true title.
Sarah Bunting, last question for this round. The snorks.
That was true.
It is true. That was their Smurfs ripoff.
Yes.
Are you sure it was an inch high private foofer?
That's what she said.
This is from TLC.
Okay.
My Big Fat Fabulous Life.
That is true.
Jeff, return to fat camp.
True.
Incorrect, that's MTV.
Oh.
Joe, ballroom boot camp.
True.
Sarah Bunting, best funeral ever.
Oh, God.
That sounds true.
It is, I wrote about it.
Yeah, I remember that. Wasn't there like a guy who had like a roulette wheel?
Yeah, no, thing? It was a Wheel of Fortune wheel, because he loved game shows. Yeah. May he rest.
The boy with a tumor for a face.
Oh, you better believe that's true.
Jeff, honey, we're killing the kids.
False.
True. It's true.
Whoa.
Jesus
Joe.
Christ.
Feeding them too much sugar. It really is.
Sextuplets take New York.
I mean, come on. I think we all remember the summer that the sextuplets took New York.
Oh, summer of Sam.
And Topher.
And Pooper.
I'm going to say false.
It's true. Sarah Bunting, totally T-Boz. Totally
true.
T-Boz. Tara Ariano, yeah. Unsolved weddings.
I have a Light feeling a this is going to be one where they're all true, but I'm... false. Whew.
Jeff, I'm too big for my house.
Shit.
That is true.
No.
Wait, hold on. I was confused. I thought you were just... That was a declarative statement.
Joe.
Are you subtracting a Dave point for that one?
Oh.
No.
I'm subtracting one from you for being so craven as Dave.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
Tara,
craven
one less Dave
now.
Point.
How
so opportunist.
Sticking up for your honor / the shapeliness of your butt. Whatever. I guess I won't do that anymore.
My totally cupcake wedding, Joe.
My totally cupcake wedding?
Yeah.
Well, that doesn't even make sense.
But knowing that it doesn't make sense, does that help you, Eddie?
No, well, because that's what Unsolved Wedding was. I was just like, well, that doesn't make sense just on its merits. And yet, I think this one is true.
Nope. All right, Sarah Bunting, last one for this round. Something borrowed, something new.
Something what?
Borrowed, something new.
What?
So something borrowed.
At first, I thought you said something moo, and I was like, creepy.
It's not a pun. Ball. These are just regular
that
words.
That made my decision much easier. Now I'm not sure. I'm going to say false.
That is an actual show. All right, guys.
House.
The penultimate round.
Oh my.
Yes.
This is the title of an episode of The Twilight Zone.
Okay.
Tara.
Yeah.
Where is everybody?
Rue. Okay.
Jeff, the ambassadors of death.
So generic sounding. I'm going to say true.
False. That was a Doctor Who story.
Yeah.
Joe. I shot an arrow into the air.
That's so stupid. And yet, not something I feel like you would make up if you were trying to make up fake Twilight Zone titles, so I'm going to say true.
Sarah Bunting, The Purple Statement.
That does sound like one you'd make up if you're trying to make up a Twilight Zone title, but maybe that's just what they want me to think. But that is what I think. False.
True.
Damn it!
Isn't yep. I shot an arrow in the air? Is like I thought that was poetry. I believe I'm remembering that from a scene. In-
oh, okay.
Anyway.
People are alike all over.
True.
Jeff Drake, what kind of
yes,
day
I'm
has
here.
It been?
True.
No. That's the Aaron Sorkin title he puts in every one of his series.
The only one on this panel that wouldn't have gotten that one right. Poor Jeff.
Yeah. I know.
Picky giveth, picky taketh away, Jeff.
It's true.
Yeah, it's so true.
Joe,
can I interrupt for a moment?
Yep.
Yes, ma'am.
The arrow line is from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow.
Yeah. So. He's got a big dick.
Thanks,
nervous
Bishop.
Man in a $4 room.
Nice.
Nervous man in a $4 room?
Yeah.
True.
Correct. Hocus Pocus and
foofer.
Frisbee. Hocus Pocus and Frisbee. Frisbee. F-R-I-S-B-Y.
Versus unbranded flying disc.
Yes.
True.
You are correct, ma'am. Tara Ariano, yes. I sing the body electric.
False.
True. Also the song from Fame, but this is a real title.
Also the song from Fame, correct. Yes.
And
so a line of poetry, Walt Whitman, just ask Gilman.
Yeah, poetry is just jazz without music.
Thank you,
yep.
Jeff.
For Jeff, black leather yes. jackets.
Black leather jackets?
Correct.
I'm going to pull a Costanza and say false.
Costanza. Joe,
damn
what's
it.
In the box?
What's in the box?
What's in the box?
It feels like it could be the title of every Twilight Zone episode.
And Seven the Series, and that's their pilot.
What's yeah.
In the box? Yep.
Exactly. I'm going to say, oh, God. True?
Correct. All right, closing out this round, Sarah, Keeper of the Purple Twilight.
Christ. True.
Why Sarah get all the purple ones?
I don't know. But that was actually from The Outer Limits. Non-union Mexican counterpart Twilight Zone. All right. Let's do a quick score break here.
Okay. Jeff has 14. Sarah has 18. Joe and I are tied with 23 APs.
Dun, dun.
All right. Last round, guys. This is a 2000 era high concept network serialized mystery series with vague sci-fi or paranormal overtones.
Got it.
Presumably greenlit after the success of Lost.
Okay.
All gotcha. Right.
Yep.
Tara.
Yes.
Invasion.
True.
Joe.
50.
No, it's Jeff.
Jeff, sorry. Surface.
True.
Joe. Threshold. Yes.
True.
Sarah, persons unknown.
False.
What?
That's an actual.
Never heard it out of my
NBC.
Damn life.
That
oh,
happened.
NBC.
Tara.
Yeah.
Ugh.
Incident.
Incident? Oh, false.
Correct.
Noun.
All right. Jeff, the 12.
True.
No, you're thinking of the 9 or lucky 7, the 11th hour or 0 hour, you're but right. Not the 12. All right.
Dozens of suckers.
Joe.
Yes.
Daybreak.
Oh, damn it. That sounds so plausible. True.
Correct.
Hey, Diggs.
Sarah Bunting, Bionic.
False.
Correct. Yeah. All right, let's hear those scores while Dave digs up a tiebreaker, he thinks.
Yeah, you will need one. Jeff has 15, Sarah has 19, and Joe and I are tied with 25 APs.
Well, that's really interesting. Gosh, that is so interesting. All right, let's see here. We're going to do a tiebreaker. And the category is... Oh, this is good for a Joe Tara tiebreaker.
Okay.
I'm going to go on points.
Okay.
Have they hosted Saturday Night Live?
Okay.
All right.
Oh, gosh.
Tara.
Yeah.
Ewan McGregor.
No.
Joe. Lucy Liu.
Yes.
MC Hammer.
No.
He has. Yeah! Robert Blake.
Oh, God.
Jesus.
Yes.
Glenn Close.
Yes.
Zoe Deschanel.
Yes.
Tom Everett Scott.
No.
Sean William Scott.
Yes.
Scott Toilet Paper. No. Topher Grace.
Oh, boy. Yes?
Carrie Russell.
No.
Michael Jordan.
Yes?
Liev Schreiber. Liev Schreiber.
No.
He should, though. He's really funny.
All right. What's the scores there after that tiebreaker round?
Joe wins by one
Yay,
point.
Joe!
Joe!
Joe.
Whew. Thank goodness I had one spare. That's it for another episode of Extra Hot. Great. Dave couldn't find his note file, but now he's got it. We put down our delicious yet soul-crushing Cinnabon pastries to discuss the season 2 opener of Better Call Saul. Liv filed her latest face-off report, and the blotter kept pace with Jeffrey Toobin's The Run for His Life. Of his life. Oh my God, guys. All right. We went around the Dallas stops at The Good Wife, Vinyl, Saturday Night Live, and Project Runway All-Stars before Jeff successfully pitched us Fargo's Before the Law for the canon. We crowned winners and losers of the week, and Joe was the winner of this week's Game Time. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tara Ariano,
Just 1 pound of ground beef, please.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Ermintrad 2016.
Joe Reed.
Fuck you, Bernie!
And Jeff Drake.
I bet my foofer.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Grade.
Well, I'm sorry, but this is the gravy train. And it's leaving the station right now. So, last chance. All aboard. Seriously, last chance. I'm going to count to say 10. And then I'm... All right, then. Your services are no longer needed.
This has been a production of the Previously.tv Podcast Network.